Time to welcome today's new technology commentator. It's Steve McCabe. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Catherine.
Can you believe that Twitter is five?
5 years old, and what I can't believe is that the anniversary was allowed to pass without comment.
Well, apart from you.
Of course.
It's off to school, which is another great passion of yours.
Yes.
The microblogging service Twitter doesn't need an introduction anymore. 140 characters is the maximum you can use when you send out your little tweet.
That's correct. And it's become enormously popular. 5 years ago, July the 15th was the actual anniversary. And the first day, they had 224 tweets. That was it. No one was really knowing what this was about. But they're saying that these days, they're getting that many tweets in about a tenth of a second. It's become quite an alarming success story.
Is that because of a huge sign-up rate, or because people just tweet uncontrollably, or what?
A bit of both, really. I mean, they're saying that at the moment, they're claiming 200 million registered users. Now, of that, it's impossible to say how many of those, basically, they sign up, they tweet, here's my first tweet, I'm on Twitter now, and then promptly forget about it. There's obviously a lot of those. But there's probably maybe 70 or 80 million active users from what I've been reading. So there's obviously a lot of people doing this. It's grown quite enormously. And I think what's really made it happen is it's not just the, oh, let's see what Lady Gaga's wearing today type of tweets. Obviously, they're very popular. A lot of people like following those. But the thing that's given it a lot of momentum has been things like the fact that it's been banned in China, it's been banned in Egypt, and those facts alone indicate that big governments are actually afraid of this thing.
It's getting having some impact.
Clearly, civilians are actually taking advantage of it to the point that the governments who are afraid of their civilians are getting afraid of the service as well.
Has it been a bit overstated? Because talk about the Arab Spring, for example, and tweeting, and I know that certainly in the Iranian uprising about 18 months ago, there was a lot of tweeting coming out of, was it Tahrir Square in that example? I can't remember whether that was later, whether it was reports of violence or crackdowns, etc. So it was being used almost like an immediate news service from places where news is censored or times when news is censored.
Well, yeah, that's precisely the way it's being used. A slightly more cheerful example, if you can put it that way, there's a 14-year-old lad called Sebastian Alegria who's in Chile, who's been tweeting earthquake updates. He's actually rigged up his own earthquake detector to what he calls a tweet bot, a little automatic computer system that puts out tweets automatically. He's got 29,000 followers, and it just means that you can put out tiny, tiny nuggets of information. You don't need to write an entire book report. You don't need to write a huge PhD thesis on what's going on. You can simply send out an immediate report. 5.4 magnitude earthquake just gone off, or the tanks have rolled into Tahrir Square. And you can make it very quick, very short, very convenient. It's a very, very nimble medium in that regard.
You mentioned it's not just what Lady Gaga's wearing. A lot of people seem to use it as like a personal, and some of it's kind of, you know, inane, but some of it it's almost like a diary that they're opening up to others to see, and they've become quite proficient at it.
Yeah, so some people do use it, you know, it's referred to as a microblogging service, and some people do use it as an electronic stream of consciousness.
For better or worse. What's the significance of having that number of sign-ups? With Facebook, of course, now everyone's trying to say, how do advertisers make money out of it? How do you start to use it as a product? What's the significance of that being that many tweeters around?
Well, it's exactly the same thing as Facebook. I mean, sooner or later, somebody will want to monetize this. They don't do this as a hobby. The valuations on this service at the moment, anything between $3.7 and $7.8 billion. You know, I don't know exactly how people are calculating that, but those are the estimations. If this product were ever to be put on the market, that's the kind of capital it could raise. But basically, it's advertising. There are so many people who are using Twitter, and it's the people who are following more than the people who are tweeting who are the revenue generating base. As long as, for example, your Lady Gagas and people like that are putting their information online, there will be people who want to follow them who will be going to the Twitter website, which then means that there are eyeballs on the screen, and therefore screen real estate becomes a commodity that can be sold.
Wow. Is it happening at all yet when it comes to Twitter?
Apparently it is, yes.
In what ways?
As I say, basically, it's advertising space that's being sold. That, as far as I can tell, is the primary marketing model that exists for Twitter at the moment.
The other, of course, the time that Twitter really took off in the public consciousness was Barack Obama's presidential elections, which is, what, getting on for 3-4 years ago. So it must have been quite a a new phenomenon then, but he used it for fundraising purposes, didn't he?
Yes, he did. That was one of the things that sort of gave it its initial momentum. As I say, it started off kind of slowly. They're saying that the first 600,000 sign-ups took nearly a year. Near a year and a half, I should say. They're getting that many sign-ups in a day now. And it was things like that. It was when they started getting their first very, very high-profile tweeters. There you go. I've heard them referred as tweeple.
That's nice, isn't it?
No, I can't bring myself to use that word myself. Yeah. Pretty loathsome.
You're not a fan, are you?
Well, no, I never really quite got it. Like I said, I see it now. When you see how it's being used at this point, yeah, it makes sense. But when it started off as that sort of stream of consciousness, hey, guess what, I'm going to the toilet now type tweets, I didn't see the point.
Perhaps we've become more sophisticated tweeters with practice.
Clearly.
The imminent demise of the optical drive.
Yes.
You have to tell me what one is first.
Well, I'm almost certain you've got one, at least one
have
of
I?
Them at home, yes.
Is it a hard drive?
No, it's not. An optical drive is going to be a drive that uses discs that are read by lasers, and that's going to be either CDs or DVDs.
Ah, so that's the thing where I push the button and it comes out and I put my thing in?
Precisely. That would be the one, yes.
What's happening to it?
Well, what's happening to it is, I mean, it's always happened that a technology comes along, works for a while, then something bigger and better comes along and supersedes it. We've always seen that. I mean, I'm sure you're not old enough to remember things like 8-track cartridges, for example. But we've had those in the past. And they were
Not knowingly, no.
Then they were replaced
I remember records.
There you go. There's a good format for you. You know, for those of you young enough not to know about these things, these big 12-inch black plastic things that used to sit on turntables. And they were brilliant in their day. But obviously they've been supplanted by CDs because, you know, that's a better technology.
Hmm.
Now, CDs were a brilliant medium for distributing computer data. 650 megabytes on a disk, brilliant. Suddenly somebody brought out DVDs and said, hang on, we can do the same thing with those. 4.3, I think it is, gigabytes on a disk. Was it 4.7? It's a lot more. You can suddenly get a lot more data on them, so they got supplanted. But what's happening now is CDs and DVDs for years have been used as a means of distributing computer software. You go to your shop, you buy your computer program, and it's on a disk, you stick it in your computer, the computer reads the data off it and installs the software onto your computer. Brilliant. What's happened is Apple, who tend to be credited at least as being drivers of the market in this regard, they've just released, as we've talked about in the past, you and I, they've released their latest operating system only on download. It's only available on the internet.
That's right. So this is the scary thing if our bandwidth, national sort of bandwidth and internet access isn't fast enough and whiz-bang enough, we're going to actually struggle to access some of be able to purchase some of this stuff.
Exactly. And what they've done now is they've taken this one step further. It's not enough that they're only selling their operating system on the internet. They've also said that in their Apple stores around the world, they're not even going to sell any of their application programs, the word processing, their photo editing, their video editing programs. They're no longer for sale in a box on an optical disc any longer. They're only going to be available for sale on the internet. And just to make the point, just to ram this home, the latest version of their Mac Mini desktop computer doesn't even have a CD-DVD reader built into it.
Oh.
Yes.
So what do we use instead? Are we using the little memory stick thingies or what?
You can use little memory stick thingies to sell software, to move software around if you want. And that is, in fact, one alternative Apple are offering if you can't download the new operating system, but they're charging more than twice the price for it. They're clearly saying, OK, if you insist, we'll do it, but we're going to make
we'll
you
make
pay
it
for
it. We'll make it as hard as possible.
Exactly.
What are the you know, implications of that then, this move, and are other companies moving to it as well?
Other companies have been sort of moving toward it little by little, but it's going to take a major player like Apple, who are finally going to say, look, we're doing this, we're taking this step, we're pulling the plug. Other people are going to say, well, hang on a second, if they're doing it, and the hardware will drive one of these decisions. They're saying, well, you know, Adobe, for example, if they suddenly realize that they can't sell Photoshop, you know, to use a famous example, if they can't sell Photoshop on DVD any longer, if the only way that they can distribute it to their Apple customers is going to be over the internet, then they're going to have to follow suit.
Okay, and when will we know that?
Well, it's going to be a gradual thing. Take, for example, the floppy disk. People said that Apple had put the nail in the coffin of that thing back in 98 when the iMac came out. And with the same kind of story back then, there was no floppy drive built into an iMac in 1998. And it was only last year, I think it was, that Sony made the last floppy disk. It takes a while for these things to finally die.
Fair enough. And then they come back as memorabilia anyway.
Exactly.
And become all trendy again.
Mm-hmm. Although you can actually use them as coasters.
You see? Recycling.
Absolutely.
We're recycling everything these days.
Why not?
Now, there are fake stores selling real stuff. That does my head in a bit.
I know, this is absolutely brilliant. You know, as I say, Apple are something of a trendy brand. You know, they get a lot of publicity. And one thing that's been coming out from China is there's an American lady there. She blogs under the name of Bird Abroad. I think probably the reason is that she doesn't want to have her name broadcast too widely. I certainly don't know what her real name is. But she's based in the town of Kunming in China. And she found herself in an Apple store there. And she was looking at the stuff. It was all, as far as she could tell, genuine Apple kit. And the staff were wearing the Apple uniforms. They got the lanyards with the name tags around them. And the thing that she said first made her notice was the fact that there were signs on the windows saying Apple Store, which Apple, in their real stores, never do. I also saw a photograph that had the word store spelled S-T-O-E-R, which is a little bit of a giveaway. And she went to look around the store. She saw the paint was peeling and it wasn't quite put together perfectly, but otherwise it was a very, very good facsimile of a genuine Apple store. It turns out the entire thing was fake. It was selling real Apple kit and it was dressed up to look like an Apple store, but Apple had no knowledge of it.
Ah, so this was basically fraud.
Oh, totally.
And what could Apple do about it?
Well, they started making all kinds of intellectual property noises and got beaten to the punch. Apparently the Chinese authorities shut them down for trading without a license.
And is this, what, an example of things that are happening quite a bit, or what?
Well, apparently, you know, now that word's got out from this one girl that she's found one, people are saying, yeah, well, we've seen those as well. Yeah, they're all over China, apparently. This is quite common.
Mind you, that happens previously with other things like sort of socks and, you know, various sort of rip-offs of labels and that kind of thing. And now, not what? It's Apple. Do you actually get anything for it, though, or you just get the bill?
Oh, no, apparently they're actually selling real kits. Customers are coming out saying, well, I don't care if the shop's real or not, so long as the iDevice I just bought is real. So instead of going down the beach in some third-world resort and buying a knock-off Rolex watch,
yeah,
you're doing exactly the opposite.
Can you be hunted down the same way, though? I suppose there are people who theoretically could stroll the beaches and stop the rip-off artists, but not so this?
Well, as I say, Apple were starting to get their intellectual property lawyers into gear, and then suddenly they realised that the Chinese had shut them down already. I'm sure that they're now on alert, just waiting for the word. But, you know, you've got all these lawyers pumped up with adrenaline, just waiting to sue somebody, and they've all gone away.
Chinese authorities not wanting this sort of
publicity?
Or I was going to say, or not wanting the material to be accessible, or is that not an issue for them? It's just the publicity.
No, actually the Chinese authorities are working very, very closely with Apple and with many other companies. I mean, Google famously sold their souls to the Chinese authorities by setting up a special behind the, what they're calling it, the Great Firewall of China, behind a censorship curtain. They've set up a Chinese Google search, which is very, very tightly censored.
Now, the old Hadron Collider
has
probably about the same age as Twitter. It's been not necessarily being used for that long, however.
No.
Now, it's in search of, and we've discussed this many times in the program, the God particle, the Higgs boson, which may or may not even exist. Are there signs that they may have got a whiff, a hint of it all?
We're getting close, they're saying. The Higgs boson, it's been like the holy grail of particle physics for quite some time now. Because scientists have always known that stuff in the universe has mass, it has heaviness, it has, you know, it actually has kilograms. But they've never quite known why. What it is that about some particles, like protons and neutrons, the ones you learn about in high school chemistry, they have mass, they're heavy. And yet ones like photons, they don't have mass. And so obviously there's something that's giving some of these particles mass. And some bloke back in 1964, a fellow called Peter Higgs, came up with the theory that there's this thing called the Higgs boson. And they've been searching for it since 1964. And so now there's two teams. There's one in Europe at the Large Hadron Collider.
Mm-hmm.
There's another team over in the US at a thing called the Tevatron, which is basically a very similar device. And they're finding that when they fire protons together, collide them at very, very particular energy ranges, they're starting to see hints of particles emerging. And I'm fudging this as carefully as I possibly can, that might well possibly be an indication that they could be getting close to maybe finding the Higgs boson.
Here's the problem with the old Higgs boson. We don't know it exists. And if it does exist, we don't really know what it ought to look like or behave like, do we? Or do we?
Well,
Is it needle in a haystack, only much smaller?
Yeah, because it'd be like looking for a needle that we don't know is it actually necessarily shaped like a needle or needle-coloured or needle-sized in the biggest haystack you've ever seen. They know it ought to exist. If it does exist, then everything falls neatly into place. If it doesn't exist, then there's going to be like 45, 50 years of assumptions that need to be overturned. So we're hoping it exists. We really need the damn thing to exist.
That said, 40 or 50 years is a hell of a long time in physics, isn't it?
Oh, it's forever, yeah. I mean, 100 years ago, the world of physics was completely and utterly different, and Einstein was still just making his mark. So yeah, I mean, 50 years is a long time to be searching for this thing. But what they've done now is they've narrowed down an energy range to get really specific. The Europeans are saying between 140 and 145 giga electron volts is the place they reckon that now they're likely to find it.
That's the speed, at which this whole thing will be circulating, or what? What does that measure?
Well, in those terms, yeah, it's a measure of, ultimately, it's an indication of the speed of the protons slamming into each other and getting shattered apart.
And as yet, we've not been sucked off into the black hole either.
No, it'll come one day, I'm sure. But no, we're not there yet.
We won't know what to do if we're in it, will we?
No, but I'm sure if we take our iPads along with us, we'll figure it out.
We could tweet, hey, it's here, the black hole, I'm in it. Unbelievable. Now, Otorewa College, yes, we have been debating, and actually we've had a really good discussion as a result. Lots of great emails on whether an iPad specifically or any other kind of personal tablet or other personal device is just going to become de rigueur. We had a really good discussion last week. You've got some views on it too?
Yeah, I mean, Nat Talkington brought his perspective along last week as a school trustee. The way I'm looking at it from is as a teacher myself at the Chalk Face. The danger I see with this, and I see this in a lot of schools, I've taught here, I've taught in the United States, and I've seen this, where technology is held up as an end in itself, where it is a good thing to have technology in the classroom, without ever stopping to think, really, why? What necessarily is it doing to enhance the learning of the students in the room? It's simply, well, it's technology, isn't it? You've got to have technology.
Yes.
And it feels like it doesn't always get much beyond that.
Well, when you're coming to this particular kind of technology, and I don't mean the iPad specifically, but the idea of a personalised tablet, what are your inclinations about whether it's just a knee-jerk, oh, we've got to have it, or whether it really could be and ought to be a valuable implement piece of technology in the classroom?
In my opinion, it can become a distraction in many ways. It's one more thing that gets potentially in between the student and the subject. I know it's going to sound really, really odd coming from somebody sitting here as a technology commentator and correspondent, but I'm actually quite a Luddite in this regard. The simplest thing you can possibly do is a pencil and a piece of paper. That's never going to crash. The technology's never going to get outdated. Your pencil doesn't run out of batteries. This is reliable technology that is, I mean, your pen's an extension of your hand in many ways. An iPad or a laptop computer, whatever it might be, isn't. It's suddenly something that can come in between the student and the subject, between the student and the learning. That's my big concern with it.
Yeah, but pen and paper kind of been handy as technology as well in education, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean,
I guess the point is this. Here we are talking about Twitter and tweeting.
Yeah.
Is the way that kids are going to both take in information and communicate, express information, going to move fundamentally from the pen and paper, if it hasn't already, to all these other kinds of instantaneous, if my thumb isn't pushing on a button, I don't even feel like I'm communicating. Is that where we're already heading if we haven't?
Well, there's two ways of approaching that. On the one hand, yeah, it's not real until it's been tweeted about. There is that way of looking at it, first of all, yeah. The second way of looking at it is the idea that the same that Google, who always the people get the blame for this, they're always the name that gets tossed up there, but the internet in general is changing the way that we think and that we access information. And increasingly, they're saying it doesn't matter whether or not you know a particular thing. What matters is whether or not you can access the information about that thing. And increasingly, the way that we're accessing the information is through our smartphones, our tablets, and our laptops. And it's reached the point now where information has to be instantly available. If I can't whip up my phone and find the answer to a question within 30 seconds, the conversation will move on. Attention spans are changing. Attitudes to expectations of instantaneous knowledge are definitely changing.
So does the personal tablet Is it not going to be basically attached to the arms of these students pretty much right through their lives, or whatever replaces it and then whatever replaces that?
Well, there
and should it be part of this critical time of their learning?
Well, there is that assumption. And I'm of the generation that saw pocket calculators getting introduced into schools. And the way I was taught by my maths teachers back in the last millennium was that you learn how to do your sums. And once you've learned that, then you can use your calculator as a convenience. But don't start off using the calculator because you won't master the skills to begin with.
Interesting stuff. Thank you very much for your time. That is our new technology communicator today, or correspondent today. It was Steve McCabe.